Don't lie to us, Kevin, John said, sounding alarmingly earnest. This is the time to come clean. I blinked in disbelief. Come on, guys. You're kidding, right? Then Richard dropped the bomb. Assistant U.S. Attorney Schindler is demanding that you agree to a CIA debriefing.
What the hell was going on?
Sure, I'd hacked the world's most popular cellular phone manufacturers, Bell operating companies, and operating system development houses throughout the United States. But I'd never even attempted to go after any government targets. How could the feds have made that leap? The accusation was completely unfounded. I don't have anything to hide, I said with a sigh. I'll participate in the debriefing so long as it's understood that I won't inform on anyone else. I didn't have any knowledge of anyone who had hacked into government or military systems, but even so, it was against my ethical and moral principles to become a snitch for the government. In the end, nothing ever came of it. Maybe Schindler or the Justice Department was just on a fishing expedition. It made me think back to the time when Marty Stolz at Intermetrics secretly told me that the super hacker the feds were chasing had compromised the CIA. I chalked it up to one more instance of the myth getting out of hand. In medieval times, the myths that built up around magicians used to cause them serious trouble. Sometimes these myths and superstitions even got them killed. A traveling performer would amaze the local villagers with tricks and sleights of hand. Because they had no idea how he was doing those tricks, they couldn't guess at the extent of his abilities. He seemed to have the power to make things appear and disappear at will. That was the point. But if anything went wrong, some cows died, the crops failed, little Sarah got sick, it was all too easy to blame the magician. If things had been different, I might secretly have enjoyed being called the world's most wanted hacker and laughed it off when people believed I was a super genius who could hack into anything, but I had a bad feeling that it was going to cost me. And I was right. The myth of Kevin Mitnick was about to make my life a whole lot harder. Because I was such a high-profile inmate, I soon needed John Azurdiaga to intervene again. The head jailer was opening all my mail, including the letters from my attorneys, which violated my attorney-client privilege. I told him to stop. He kept right on doing it. I warned him that my lawyer would get the court to order him to stop. He ignored me. John got the court order. The jailer had to comply, but he was furious about it. So he called the U.S. Marshal Service and told them to move me to another jail, which they did. The Vance County Jail made Johnston look like a Holiday Inn. When I was being moved, a deputy U.S. Marshal with a southern accent so thick it sounded like he was doing a bad parody of a good old boy sheriff laughed and said, "You're the only prisoner we ever had that got booted out of jail." After I'd been in jail for about 5 months, my court-appointed public defender in Raleigh, John Dusenbury, recommended that I agree to what is known as a Rule 20. This meant that I would plead guilty to a single count of possessing the mobile phone number and electronic serial number pairs that I used for cloning my cell phone in exchange for a recommended sentence of 8 months, though I might still be facing up to 20 years if the judge decided not to go along with the prosecutor's recommendation. Judge Terrence Boyle approved the deal, though. Even better, my case was now transferred to Los Angeles for sentencing and to resolve the pending violation of supervised release, which meant I would be transferred as well. My move to Los Angeles from Raleigh was surprisingly awful. Federal prisons are notorious for a form of punishment known as diesel therapy. It's so bad that prisoners often consider it among the cruelest aspects of being incarcerated. What ought to be a simple drive is deliberately and maliciously extended for days or even weeks. Along the way, prisoners are subjected to as much pure misery as their sadistic guards can heap on. After being woken up at 3:30 a.m., any prisoners who are due to be transported are put in a large room and strip-searched. A chain around each prisoner's waist connects tightly to his handcuffs at stomach level so he can barely move his arms. His feet are shackled too so he can barely walk or move. Then he and his fellow inmates are loaded onto a bus and driven for 8 hours each day with random stops in towns along the route where everyone disembarks spends the night in another cell, and is woken up again the next morning to go through the whole process again. Eventually, you arrive at your destination feeling completely exhausted. During my diesel therapy back to Los Angeles, I was detained in Atlanta for several weeks. The federal penitentiary there was by far the scariest of any of the prisons I was held in the whole time I was in custody. The high walls of the prison are lined with coiled razor wire fences. There is no doubt that you're walking into a dungeon. At every entry, there are big electronic doors and gates. The deeper you go into the bowels of the prison, the more you realize there is no way out. When I was finally moved again, I was flown to several prisons in different states across the country. By the time I arrived in Los Angeles, I was not in a tolerant mood. When I got off the plane, the deputy U.S. Marshal gave me a big grin and said smugly, "Hey, Mitnick, so the U.S. Marshals finally caught you. It's all about good police work." "The U.S. Marshals had nothing to do with it," I told him. "It was a smarter civilian working for the FBI. The deputy's face fell as all the other inmates around me laughed. Back in Los Angeles, I was charged with violating the conditions of my supervised release by hacking into a Pacific Bell security agent's voicemail, along with lesser infractions like associating with Louis DePayne. After 10 months, my two-man pro bono legal team came to me with the plea agreement offered by federal prosecutor Schindler. I could hardly believe what I was hearing. 8 years in prison, and that wasn't even the worst of it. This was what was called a non-binding plea agreement, meaning that the judge wouldn't be bound by the prosecutor's recommendation, but would instead be free to set a much stiffer sentence. Even worse, I would be agreeing to pay millions of dollars in restitution, a sum that might well be more than I would earn in the rest of my life. And I would have to assign any profits from telling my story to my hacking victims, Sun, Novell, Motorola, and so on. John Izurdiaga and Richard Steingard are two dedicated attorneys, and they had put in many, many hours defending me pro bono. Nevertheless, I had been offered an unbelievably bad deal. Clearly, I would either need to be vigorously defended at trial or work out a better deal with the government. The problem was, I was in no financial position to hire an attorney. Ironically, if I really had been tapping into those 20,000 credit cards before my arrest, I would have been able to afford an attorney who had significant resources to defend the case at trial, or could have punched holes in the prosecution's case to get much better settlement terms. While I was pondering what to do, Bonnie came to visit and to tell me that Louis DePayne's attorney, Richard Sherman, was willing to represent me for free. She claimed he wanted to help because he didn't think the government was prosecuting my case fairly, and he believed I needed an aggressive lawyer. It sounded good, but I was wary. Sherman wasn't just Lewis's lawyer, but also his friend. Still, he came to see me himself and talked convincingly about winning at trial. After weighing the option of a minimal 8-year deal and discussing it with my family, I decided to accept Sherman's offer. For several weeks, he did absolutely nothing on my case except to ask the court to allow me additional research time in the prison law library, a request that was summarily denied. The aggressive defense he'd promised me never materialized. He took my case and basically sat on it. Soon after he became my attorney of record, I discovered the extent of the deception. When I called Sherman one day to discuss my case, Ron Austin answered the phone. I recognized his voice. Austin was the informant who had recorded my calls for FBI agent Ken McGuire. Sherman quickly assured me that Ron didn't have access to my case files, but that wasn't the point. These people weren't on my side. When I realized that, I was as livid with Sherman for making an empty promise to put on a vigorous defense as I was with myself for having believed him. Sherman, unlike any reasonable lawyer, instead of arguing for my release, actually demanded that the government indict me. "If you have something against my client, just indict him and let's go to trial," he insisted. For a defense attorney to do that seemed outrageous. But that's exactly what the government did. On September 26, 1996, after being held for over a year and a half, I was indicted by a grand jury in Los Angeles on 25 charges, including computer and wire fraud, copying proprietary source code, possessing access devices, computer passwords, damaging computers, inserting backdoors, and intercepting passwords. These were, of course, added to the original set of cell phone cloning charges from Raleigh. For an indigent defendant, which I was, the judge can either direct that a federal public defender be assigned or turn to the ranks of what are called panel attorneys. These are lawyers in private practice who take on indigent clients for a fraction of the rate that any well-established attorney would charge. At the time, the rate for panel attorneys was $60 an hour. A panel attorney, Donald Randolph, was selected to handle my defense, and the new charges would be heard by Judge William Keller, referred to around the courthouse as Killer Keller because courthouse regulars said, a defendant unfortunate enough to suffer a conviction in his courtroom, or even one who pled guilty, could expect the maximum sentence. Killer Keller was the Central District of California's hanging judge. He was every defendant's worst nightmare. But I got a huge break. My other cases were being heard by Judge Mariana Filzer, the same judge who had been responsible for my being held in solitary for over 8 months, but at least she didn't have as scary a reputation as Killer Keller. I really dodged a bullet there. Attorney Randolph asked Judge Filzer to have the new case transferred to her under the low-number rule, which allows related cases to be combined and heard by the judge handling the case with the lowest docket number, that is, the one assigned at the earliest date. Since the cases were related, she agreed. 9 months after I was indicted on the 25 counts, the smaller ones, the Raleigh charges and the supervised release case, were finally settled. I was sentenced to 22 months. I had already been in custody 4 months longer than that. Attorney Randolph made an immediate request for a detention hearing, since I was now eligible for release on bail. The Supreme Court had held that every defendant had a right to a bail hearing. When my attorney told Judge Filzer that he had filed an application for bail to be heard the following week, the prosecutor objected, calling me a flight risk and a danger to the community. Her Honor said, "I'm not giving him bail, so there is no need for a hearing. Take it off calendar." This was widely seen as a blatant denial of my constitutional rights. According to my attorney, no one in the history of the United States had ever been refused a bail hearing. Not the notorious imposter and escape artist Frank Abagnale Jr., not the serial killer and cannibal Jeffrey Dahmer, not even the crazed stalker and would-be presidential assassin John Hinckley Jr. As if that wasn't bad enough, my situation quickly got much worse. A defendant has the right to see the evidence the prosecution plans to use against him at trial, but the government lawyers continually gave reasons in court for not turning all the evidence over to my attorney. Most of the discovery was in electronic format, the files seized from my computers, floppy disks, and unencrypted backup tapes. My lawyer then asked the judge to allow him to bring a laptop into the prison visiting area so he could review the electronic evidence with me. Again, Judge Filzer denied the request, adding, "We're never in the world going to do that." She apparently believed that just sitting in front of a computer, even under my attorney's supervision, I could somehow cause great damage. There was no wireless internet in 1998, so it would have been impossible for me to pull an internet connection out of thin air, but she simply didn't know enough about how computers worked to have any idea whether I could connect to the outside world. And besides, the prosecutors kept warning her that I would have access to the victim's proprietary source code, or that I might write a computer virus that could somehow be released into the wild. As a result, we weren't permitted to examine any of the electronic evidence against me that was key to the government's case. When my attorney asked the judge to order the government to print out the files, the prosecutor said that there were far too many of them, so many that they would fill up the entire courtroom, and the judge refused to order the government to comply. As word got around about the unfairness of my predicament, Eric Corley rallied a group of supporters who wrote articles on websites, spread the word in the online community, passed out flyers and pasted bright yellow and black bumper stickers that said, "Free Kevin," all over the place. Eric even sent some to me in custody. On my 35th birthday, while I was being detained at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Los Angeles, my supporters wanted to come visit me, but as a pretrial detainee, I was allowed visits only from my immediate family and legal counsel. When I spoke to Eric on the phone, I told him I would go to the law library on the third floor of the detention center at exactly 1:30 p.m. Eric and the members of the Free Kevin movement located the window and positioned themselves across the street. Then, when the guards weren't looking, I pressed a Free Kevin bumper sticker against the window. Eric snapped a photo that ended up being used on the box cover of his documentary film about my case, Freedom Downtime. Sometime later, the crowd started a demonstration across the street from the detention center itself. I looked out the window of another inmate's room to see a parade on the street below, a chain of people holding up a big yellow and black Free Kevin banner and Free Kevin picket signs. Apparently, this made the prison officials nervous. Shortly afterward, the entire prison was locked down for security reasons. With the growing public awareness of my case, nearly 2 years after my attorney demanded that the government turn over discovery materials, Judge Filzer finally relented and allowed me to use a laptop computer to review the evidence with my attorney. I never knew what made her change her mind. Maybe another judge had pointed out that she risked being reversed on appeal. Or perhaps someone had explained that without connecting the laptop to a modem and phone line, there was no way I could damage anything. Whenever I was at the courthouse for a hearing, I realized the deputy marshals would turn their badges around any time they had to be near me. My attorney and I both wondered what that was about. Later, when he was visiting me in the courthouse lockup, he noticed some text blotted out on the visiting form he had to sign. When he held it up to the light, he could read the print through the paper. He shook his head and said to me, "You're not going to believe this." Then he read me the blacked-out text. "Please be aware that if Mitnick is taken into custody, he possesses an amazing ability to disrupt one's personal life through his computer knowledge, i.e., TRWs, phone service, etc. Exercise extreme caution in leaving anything about which would have personal information about yourself." Unbelievable! I guess they really were worried I had magical powers. The myth of Kevin Mitnick was about to take another really ugly turn. Before my case could even go to trial, Markoff and Shimmy were cashing in on the story. They had already written a book about it together in 1996. Now they had sold the movie rights to that book for a film to be called Takedown. Luckily, one of the costume designers working on the film leaked a copy of the screenplay for Takedown to 2600 magazine. When I read the script, it literally turned my stomach. The screenwriters had cast me as an evil villain and portrayed me as doing things I had never done in real life, such as hacking into hospitals and endangering patients' lives by altering their medical records. I was horrified. One particularly preposterous scene even showed me violently assaulting Shimmy by grabbing a metal trash can cover and slamming him over the head with it. Frankly, I couldn't imagine either one of us engaging in such a ridiculous fight. When he saw the script, Eric Corley wrote online that it was far worse than I had ever imagined. If it were made into a film, he said, Kevin will be forever demonized in the eyes of the public. In an article for ZDTV, Kevin Polson wrote, "Nobody predicted that the script, supposedly based on the dry but inoffensive book of the same name, would be filled with so much blatant fabrication. No one expected that Kevin Mitnick might become the most feared and hated screen villain since Hannibal Lecter." Appalled by the false portrayal of me in the movie script, my supporters picketed Miramax Studios in New York on July 16, 1998. Eric Corley brought international media attention to the fact that the script was filled with blatant lies. Eric was also responsible for getting the word out about the civil liberties issues its release would raise for my case. All of us were concerned that the movie would prejudice my trial. During a phone call we had around that time while I was still in pretrial detention, Alex Kasparovicius told me that Brad Weston, one of the producers of Takedown, was very eager to talk with me. I agreed to let Alex three-way Weston onto our call. Brad said he wanted my cooperation on the film. He also said that Skeet Ulrich, who had been cast to play me, wanted to speak with me. I told Brad that I had read the script and found it to be mostly false and defamatory. I said I was planning to hire an attorney. Brad said the production company would gladly pick up my attorney's fees. They would prefer to settle with me as soon as possible, rather than run the risk that a court case might delay the release of the film. Two well-known Los Angeles libel attorneys, Barry Langbird and Debbie Drews, saw that some, though not all, of the absurdly false stuff was removed from the script. They also secured a decent settlement for me, though I'm not allowed to disclose the details. Because that settlement came in before my criminal case was resolved, there was some concern that the judge might seize the money as part of a restitution payment. My attorney declared the income in camera, meaning for the judge's eyes only, and the judge allowed me to keep it private. So the prosecutors never learned that I had received money from the producers of the film. In the end, the movie version of Takedown was so widely panned on its own merits that it was never distributed theatrically in the United States. As I understand it, after a few faltering attempts in French theaters, it went straight to DVD. Meanwhile, my attorney had appealed Judge Filzer's no-bail hearing ruling to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which ruled in an unpublished opinion that I was a flight risk and a danger to the community, completely sidestepping the question of whether the government had to prove this in a hearing. We then took it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, with my attorney sending the brief to Justice John Paul Stevens. He took an interest and recommended that my case be heard, but when he sent it to the full court for a decision about putting it on the calendar, his colleagues declined. Not long after that, I was alarmed to hear that the government prosecutors were alleging I had caused damages in the mind-boggling amount of over $300 million. Of course, there was absolutely no foundation for this figure. My lawyer quickly pointed out that corporations are required by the Securities and Exchange Commission to report material losses to their stockholders, but not one of the companies in any of its quarterly or annual reports had ever claimed the loss of a single penny as a result of my hacking. Just a few weeks after I was arrested, FBI Special Agent Kathleen Carson had been working to come up with these greatly exaggerated loss numbers. An internal Sun Microsystems memo showed she had told Lee Patch, vice president of Sun's legal department, that the Solaris source code I had copied could be valued at $80 million, which would have called for the harshest sentence for fraud under the federal sentencing guidelines. So it doesn't take a genius to figure out how she came up with that number. When she asked Sun to put a dollar value on the loss associated with the break-in, she advised that the figure should be based on the value of the source code. This was like nabbing someone for stealing a can of Coke and demanding that he repay the cost of developing Coca-Cola's secret formula. Someone at the FBI had decided that the best way to inflate the claim for damages was for the companies to report how much it had cost them to develop the software I copied. But they still had their software. They were not deprived of it. So it doesn't justify claiming a loss equal to the value of developing the source code. A reasonable figure would have been the value of a source code license, which was probably under $10,000. However much they wanted to punish me, we all knew that the company's actual losses were far, far less than alleged. If anything, they amounted to the man-hours spent investigating my intrusions, reinstalling the operating system and application software in any system I had compromised, and whatever licensing fees they charged customers to purchase a source code license. The $300 million claim against me for damages was so outrageous that it motivated my supporters to ramp up the Free Kevin movement. Every time the government did something that reeked of unfairness, the numbers of my supporters only grew. Free Kevin was now a growing grassroots movement that had spread across the country and even reached as far away as Russia. When Eric organized a protest, the television news showed crowds parading with Free Kevin picket signs outside federal courthouses in 15 different cities, from Portland, Maine to Los Angeles, from Spokane to Atlanta, and in Moscow, near the Kremlin. Eric recapped the unfairness in 2600 magazine. Since February 15, 1995, Mitnick has been held in a pretrial facility with no bail hearing for possession of software allegedly worth millions of dollars. But the companies asserting this have never proven these claims, nor have they reported these losses to their stockholders, as is required by law. Computer and legal experts generally agree that it's very unlikely there really was any real damage, and that the high numbers assume every file and its associated research were wiped from existence. In actuality, no such damage was ever reported. Yet, Mitnick remains imprisoned as if this was what happened. My supporters wanted the government to respect my constitutional rights to the presumption of innocence and a fair trial within a reasonable time. As I understood it, the Free Kevin demonstrators in these cities around the world didn't necessarily think that all the charges should be dropped and I should be allowed to walk out of prison scot-free, but they objected to the obvious unfairness in the case, the denial of a bail hearing, the illegal search and seizure, the defense's lack of access to evidence, the court's refusal to pay my court-appointed attorney's fees, which effectively denied me representation for 4 months, and the claims of hundreds of millions of dollars in damages for copying source code. When people realized what was happening, momentum started to grow. The press was writing about the protests. People were putting Free Kevin bumper stickers on their cars and in shop windows. There were even people walking around in Free Kevin t-shirts and wearing Free Kevin badges and pins. During the court protests, I looked out the small window of my prison cell and actually saw an airplane dragging a Free Kevin banner. I had to pinch myself. I couldn't believe it was really happening. Over the previous 4 years, I'd had to deal with libelous reporters, uncomprehending judges, superstitious marshals, manipulative friends, and exploitative filmmakers fanning the flames of the myth of Kevin Mitnick for their own agendas. The idea that there were people out there who could finally see what I'd been going through brought me much comfort. The support was so encouraging, in fact, that it motivated me to gear up for the fight. I'd found a recent case in the prison's law library that had convinced me I might be able to beat the most serious charges. When I told my lawyer, Donald Randolph, that I'd found a legal precedent that could change everything, he said, "Let me worry about that, Kevin. I'm the lawyer." But when I showed him the case, his eyes widened. In 1992, an IRS agent named Richard Chubinsky had used his access to IRS computers to snoop into the tax returns of various political figures, celebrities, and other government officials. He did it out of curiosity. He was charged, like me, with computer and wire fraud and convicted in December 1995. After being sentenced to 6 months in prison, he successfully appealed his case. The federal appellate court held that Chubinsky, like me, had never intended to either use or disclose the information, but had simply accessed it for his own curiosity. He won the appeal, his convictions were reversed, and he never went to prison. With such a clear legal precedent, I believed we had a chance to beat the government's case. I eagerly told my attorney that I wanted to go to trial. The strategy I proposed was this. I'd admit to hacking, but argue that I was not guilty of wire or computer fraud because, like Chubinsky, I had done it merely to satisfy my own curiosity. Randolph agreed that Chubinsky's case set a perfect precedent for my defense, but there was a bigger problem. Randolph hesitated slightly before he told me what it was. I could see he was trying to be tactful. It seemed to be time for him to say something that, until now, had been left unsaid. One of the government prosecutors had been urging my attorney for weeks to persuade me to take a plea. Over the last few days, he'd even resorted to ultimatums. If I didn't agree to plead guilty and settle the case, he warned, the government would put me through a revolving door of criminal trials. If they lost in one jurisdiction, they'd try me in another. If they won, they'd press for the maximum sentence. It wouldn't matter to them whether or not they got convictions, because they'd have me locked up without bail the whole time. I was ready to fight, but now my own attorney, Randolph, was telling me as tactfully as he could, "I think you should take the plea." And then he explained, "If we go to trial, you'll have to testify, and that will leave you open to cross-examination about other things." Those other things were all the wild stories that had circulated for years about my hacking, the rumors that I had gotten into the CIA, the FBI, and even NORAD. Not to mention the many other things I had done in my hacking career but not been charged with, manipulating phone company switches all across America, getting information from the California DMV, tapping into an FBI informant's phone call, listening to voicemail messages of Pacific Bell security agents, and so much more. I could see what Randolph meant. During the cross-examination by the prosecutor, I could open myself up to other charges because the government could ask me anything related to my hacking activities if I took the stand. We didn't really want to get into all of that. So, I took the plea, with terms much better than those of the original plea I had been offered nearly 3 years earlier. As for my condition of supervised release, for 3 years I wouldn't be permitted to touch any electronic devices, such as a computer, cell phone, fax machine, pager, word processor, and so on, without the prior written permission of my probation officer. Even worse, I was forbidden to access a computer through a third party. The government didn't even want me to make an airline reservation without asking permission first. So how, I wondered, was I supposed to find work? I also wouldn't be able to act as a consultant in any computer-related activity. The many, many conditions placed on my release seemed unreasonably harsh, and a number of them were so broad that I worried I might violate them inadvertently. The government set these broad conditions not only to punish me, but also because they were trying to cover all the bases to prevent me from finding loopholes, ways around the restrictions. In the end, on March 16, 1999, I signed the deal. The prosecution this time was willing to go with a binding plea agreement, which meant that Judge Filzer would have to sentence me to the agreed terms, or I could withdraw my plea and go to trial. I pled guilty to 7 counts hand-picked by government prosecutors in Northern and Southern California. Other jurisdictions also wanted a piece of me, which included wire fraud, social engineering people over the phone into sending me source code, computer fraud, copying source code, possession of access devices, passwords, and interception of data communications, installing network sniffers to grab passwords. During the settlement discussions, the prosecution asked for $1.5 million in restitution payments. Fortunately, federal law required the court to take into account my ability to pay, so even though Judge Filzer surely wanted to come down hard on me, she had to take my potential earnings into consideration. Because of my onerous conditions of release, the probation officer calculated that I would be able to get only a minimum wage job like flipping burgers. So Judge Filzer based the amount of my restitution on the probation officer's projection of my earning minimum wage over a 3-year period. Instead of the millions proposed earlier, I was ordered to pay $4,125. After my release, I asked my dad to put my Lompoc prison ID card up for auction on eBay for me. When eBay administrators yanked it down because it didn't meet the company's community standards, they did me a huge favor. The act generated a media feeding frenzy. The story was quirky enough that it became a top news item on CNN. I then put the card on Amazon, where it was once again yanked for the same reason. Thank you, Amazon. A guy in Europe finally snapped it up for a whopping $4,000, way more than I'd ever expected to get. With a big smile on my face, I brought the proceeds into the probation office, along with the extra $125, and paid off the restitution order. I like to think that made my Lompoc ID a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card. The government was furious over that little stunt. The Bureau of Prisons publicly stated that the card was our property and tried to figure out a way to seize the money. I never heard another word about it. On August 9th, 1999, I was officially sentenced to an additional 46 months in custody, consecutive to the 22 months I received for violating my supervised release and making free cellular phone calls. Since I'd already spent 4.5 years in jail waiting, my time was almost up. Several weeks later, I was transferred to the Federal Correctional Institution in Lompoc, where I was met by a trio of men in suits. I'd find out later they were the unit manager, the captain, the head of security for the prison, and an associate warden. I knew this probably wasn't what happened to every arriving prisoner. It turned out they were there to warn me to stay away from computers and telephones. If I started messing around with the equipment, they said, "There will be hell to pay." Then I was told I had to find a job in the prison within 72 hours or they would find one for me, and it won't be very pleasant. A conversation with another prisoner turned up the interesting news that there was an opening for an inmate in the telecom department. "Do you have any experience with phones, Mitnick?" the supervisor asked. "Not too much," I said. "I know how to plug it into a jack, but don't worry, I'm a quick learner." He offered to train me. For 2 days, my prison job at Lompoc was installing and repairing the prison's telephones. On the third day, the PA system blared, "Mitnick to the unit manager's office. Mitnick to the unit manager's office." That didn't sound good. When I got there, I was again confronted by the three suits of my welcoming committee, and they were livid. I tried to point out that they had ordered me to find a job, and the supervisor of the telecom department had taken me on. They were pissed. For the next several weeks, my new job was one of the worst in the prison, in the kitchen, washing pots and pans. On January 21st, 2000, in the early morning hours, I was taken to receiving and discharge. I had served my time and was up for release, but I was stressed. A few months before, a California state case against me for attempting to trick the DMV into sending me photographs of Joseph Wernley, Joseph Ways, and Eric Hines, a.k.a. Justin Peterson, had been dismissed, but it had left me feeling uneasy. As I waited to be set free, I worried that some other state or federal agency might be lying in wait outside the gates to arrest me. I'd heard of prisoners being released only to be picked up for something else the moment they got out the door. I paced nervously back and forth in the holding cell, waiting. When I finally walked out of Lompoc, I could hardly believe I was free to go. My mom and Aunt Chickie were there to pick me up. My dad had wanted to come, but he had suffered a mild heart attack and had a recent triple bypass that ended in a severe staph infection. So he couldn't make it. A mass of reporters and camera crews were there. Eric Corley and a large, excited crowd of Free Kevin fans were there as well. As we stood talking, the prison sent out chaser vehicles to urge us farther from the prison grounds, but I didn't care. I felt like a new man. Would what lay ahead be a repetition of my past, or something quite different? As it turned out, what lay ahead was a whole new life I could never have imagined. 38. Aftermath. A reversal of fortune. It's a challenge to describe my life since walking out of prison, but the story would not be complete without this update. In March 2000, 2 months after my release, a letter arrived from Senator Fred Thompson asking me if I would fly to Washington to testify before the Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs. I was surprised, delighted, and flattered that they recognized and respected my computer skills enough to want to hear my ideas about how to protect the government's computer systems and networks. I had to ask the probation office for permission to travel to Washington, D.C. I imagine I must have been one of the few people under the office jurisdiction, if not the only one ever, who gave testifying before a Senate committee as a reason for requesting travel permission. The topic was to be cyber attack. Is the government safe? My close friend and supporter, Jack Biello, had a good way with words and helped me craft my written testimony. We've all seen committee meetings on C-SPAN, but being ushered in and sitting there in front of that raised platform with the familiar faces of nationally known political leaders peering down at you, ready to soak up your words, well, the experience has a magical quality about it. The room was packed. I was the lead witness in a hearing chaired by Senator Fred Thompson with a panel that included Senators Joseph Lieberman and John Edwards. Though nervous at first when reading my testimony, I felt a flood of confidence surge through me when the Q&A started. Much to my own surprise, I apparently did an impressive job, even offering some jokes and being rewarded with laughter. The text of my remarks is available online at hsgac.senate.gov/030200_mitnick.htm. Following my testimony, Senator Lieberman asked a question about my history of hacking. I responded by talking about how my motive had been to learn, not to profit or cause harm, and mentioned the case of that IRS agent, Richard Chubinsky, whose conviction had been overturned when the court accepted his argument that he had accessed information only out of curiosity. He never intended to use or disclose the information. Lieberman, obviously impressed by my testimony and by my reference to a legal precedent I had myself uncovered, suggested that I should become a lawyer. With my felony conviction, it's unlikely I'd be admitted to the bar, I said, but maybe one day you'll be in a position to pardon me. That drew a big laugh. It was as if a magic door had opened. People started calling me for speaking engagements. My career options seemed to be so severely limited by the conditions of my release that I had been near despair. And now, after my congressional testimony, the possibility of a lucrative speaking career was suddenly taking shape. The only trouble was I had terrible stage fright. It took more hours than I'd like to remember and many thousands of dollars paid to a speaking coach to help me overcome this fear. As part of my fearful induction into public speaking, I joined the local Toastmasters group. Ironically, their meetings were held at General Telephone's main offices in Thousand Oaks, where I'd once worked ever so briefly. My Toastmasters visitor pass gave me unfettered access to the offices inside the building. I couldn't help but smile every time I walked in, thinking about how completely freaked out the folks in security would be if they only knew. One of the interview requests I received around this time was from the U.S. Commission on National Security in the 21st Century, a think tank that presents security recommendations to Congress and the President. A pair of men from the Department of Defense representing the commission came to my apartment in Thousand Oaks and spent 2 days asking me how government and military computer networks could be made more secure. To my surprise, I was also invited to appear on a number of news shows and talk shows. Suddenly, I was a kind of media celebrity, giving interviews to leading international publications, including The Washington Post, Forbes, Newsweek, Time, The Wall Street Journal, and The Guardian. The online site Brill's Content asked me to write a monthly column. Since I wasn't allowed anywhere near a computer, the people at Brill's said they would be willing to accept my drafts in longhand. Meanwhile, other unusual job offers came pouring in as well. A security company wanted me to serve on its advisory board, and Paramount Studios invited me to consult on a possible new television series. On hearing about these offers, however, my probation officer, Larry Hawley, informed me that I could not write articles about computer technology or participate in any other kind of work in which the topic was even discussed. He insisted that the probation office considered all such work to be computer consulting, which I was not allowed to do without his express permission. I countered that writing about a subject didn't mean I was a consultant. The articles were intended for the general public. I was doing essentially the same type of work that former hacker Kevin Polson had done while he was on supervised release. Undeterred, I sought out legal counsel. Sherman Ellison, an attorney friend, agreed to represent me pro bono. Naturally, this meant that I would have to plead my case before Judge Filzer. Our more recent 3-year-long judicial relationship had not done much to improve our mutual regard. Neither of us was glad to see the other. The court had no doubt that we would be getting together with Mr. Mitnick again, Judge Filzer said. What she meant, of course, was that she had been expecting me to be brought in on new charges or for violating the terms of my supervised release. But in the end, she made it clear that the attorneys would have to work it out among themselves and stressed that she did not want to see me back in her courtroom. She was obviously tired of the Mitnick case. The probation office got the message. Be a bit more flexible in the Mitnick case so he doesn't end up on calendar again. The probation office started being more reasonable and accommodating toward me. In the fall of 2000, just after I finished an interview on Bill Handel's very popular morning show on Los Angeles radio station KFIAM 640, I spoke with the station's program director, David G. Hall. He explained that internationally syndicated talk show host Art Bell would be retiring soon and wanted to suggest me to the syndicator, Premier Radio Network, as his possible replacement. What an amazing compliment. I was stunned. I admitted that I had no experience in hosting talk radio and, in fact, had hardly ever listened to those shows myself, but I said I was willing to give it a try. A few days later, I auditioned as a guest host on the Tim and Neil show, and David offered me my own show, to be called The Dark Side of the Internet. Later, I brought in my close friend, Alex Kasparovicius, to co-host with me. We exposed the dark corners of the Internet, telling listeners how to protect their privacy, and answering listeners' call-in questions on how to best secure their personal computers, among other things, and talked about all kinds of cool sites and services that were appearing online. David Hall, a recognized leader in radio programming, gave me only 3 words of advice. The show must be entertaining, relevant, and informative. Right away, I invited on guests like Steve Wozniak, John Draper, and even porn star Danny Ash, who took her top off in the studio to show us all how hot she was. Listen up, Howard Stern, I'm following in your footsteps. Because I still wasn't allowed to use a computer, the station was kind enough to provide me with a producer screener who would go beyond that job's typical duties and help me with my internet research. The hour-long show aired every Sunday. During that hour, the station went from being 14th in the Arbitron ratings to second. And, defying the assumptions that Judge Filzer had used to calculate the dollar amount of my restitution, I earned $1,000 for each show. During my stint as a talk show host, J.J. Abrams, the famous film and television producer, contacted me. He said he was a fan and had even placed a free Kevin bumper sticker on a set in his hit television series Felicity. After we met at a studio in Burbank, he invited me to do a small cameo as an FBI agent on his show Alias, as an in-joke. In a script change, I ended up as a CIA agent working against the treacherous SD6. The federal government refused to give me permission to type on a working computer for the scene, so the prop master had to make sure the keyboard was disconnected. I appeared on camera with Jennifer Garner, Michael Vartan, and Greg Grunberg. It was awesome. One of the most enjoyable experiences I've ever had. Around the summer of 2001, I got a phone call from a man named Eddie Munoz, who knew of my past hacking exploits and wanted to hire me to fix a rather unusual problem. His highly successful service in providing dancers available on call in Las Vegas had dropped off very significantly. Eddie felt certain that the mafia had hacked Sprint's phone switch and reprogrammed it so that most of the calls to Eddie's service would be diverted to other call girl services run by the mob. Munoz had filed a complaint with the Public Utilities Commission, PUC, against Sprint, claiming that his business was suffering because the company had not secured its infrastructure properly against hackers. He wanted to hire me as an expert witness for the commission hearing. Initially, I was skeptical that Sprint was at fault for Eddie's declining revenue, but I agreed to testify about the company's vulnerabilities. During the hearing, I described how I had been hacking into phone companies for years, including Sprint. I explained that the CALRS system Sprint used for testing was similar to Pacific Bell's SAS, but with what I thought was even better security. Anyone trying to access the remote CALRS test units in each central office had to give the correct response to a challenge in order to get access. The system was programmed with 100 different challenges, double digits from 00 to 99, each of which had its own response of 4 hex characters, such as B7A6 or DD8C. Hard to crack, except through wiretapping or social engineering. The way I'd gotten around it, I told the commission, was by calling the manufacturer of the system, Northern Telecom, claiming to be with Sprint's engineering department, and saying I was building a custom testing tool that needed to communicate with the CALRS test units in each central office. The technician faxed me the seed list of all 100 challenges and responses. One of Sprint's attorneys challenged my testimony. Mr. Mitnick is a social engineer. Lying was part of his stock in trade, and you can't believe anything he says. Not only did he absolutely deny that Sprint had been hacked or could be hacked in the future, but he pointed out that I'd literally written the book on lying, The Art of Deception, about which more in a moment. One of the PUC staffers confronted me, saying, "You have offered all these claims, but haven't offered a shred of evidence. Do you have any way of proving Sprint can be hacked?" It was a long shot, but there was just a chance I might be able to prove it. During the lunch break, I went to a storage locker I had opened while in Las Vegas just before going on the run. It was crammed with cell phones, chips, printouts, floppy disks, and more. Stuff I couldn't take with me, but didn't want to lose and couldn't risk leaving at my mom's or Graham's, where the feds might show up with a search warrant and find it all. Incredibly, in that big pileup of old goods, I found what I was looking for. A sheet of paper, by now tattered, dog-eared, and dusty, containing the CALRS seed list. On my way back to the hearing room, I stopped at a Kinko's and had enough copies made for the commissioner, lawyers, clerk, and staff. Kevin Polson, who by this time had become a highly respected technology reporter, had flown to Las Vegas to cover the hearing as a journalist. Here is what he wrote about my return to the witness stand. If the system is still in place and they haven't changed the seed list, you could use this to get access to CALRS, Mitnick testified. The system would allow you to wiretap a line or seize dial tone. Mitnick's return to the hearing room with the list generated a flurry of activity at Sprint's table. Ann Pongratz, the company's general counsel, and another Sprint employee strode quickly from the room, Pongratz already dialing on a cell phone while she walked. The fact that two Sprint people were ashen-faced as they rushed out of the room made the situation clear enough. Sprint was probably still using the same CALRS devices, programmed with the identical seed list, and Pongratz and her colleague must have recognized that I could hack into CALRS anytime I liked and gain the power to wiretap any phone in Las Vegas. Though I was vindicated, Eddie didn't fare as well. Proving that Sprint could be hacked wasn't the same as proving that the mob or anybody else had actually done any hacking to reroute Eddie's flow of calls and steal business from him. Eddie was left empty-handed. In the fall of 2001, a whole new chapter started in my life when I was introduced to literary agent David Fugate. David thought my story was extraordinary. He quickly contacted John Wiley & Sons and proposed that I author a book on social engineering to help businesses and consumers alike protect themselves against the kind of attacks I had been so successful at carrying out. Wiley showed enthusiasm for the deal, and David recommended a seasoned co-author named Bill Simon to work with me in developing the book, which came to be called The Art of Deception. For most people, landing an agent, a credited co-author, and a legitimate publishing deal is the most difficult part of getting a book published. For me, the question was, how could I write a book without a computer? I looked at the standalone word processors everybody used before the introduction of personal computers. Since they weren't even able to communicate with other computers, I thought I had a pretty solid argument, so I presented it to my probation officer. His answer was completely unexpected. He dismissed the word processor idea and told me I could use a laptop computer so long as I didn't access the internet and promised to keep it secret from the media. While Bill and I were writing our book, Eric Corley released Freedom Downtime, the documentary about the Free Kevin movement. It went a long way toward counteracting the gross inaccuracies of Takedown. It even contained footage in which John Markoff admitted that his single source for claiming I'd hacked into NORAD was a convicted phone freak known for spreading false rumors. When it came out, The Art of Deception quickly became an international bestseller, published in 18 foreign editions. Even today, years later, it's still one of Amazon's most popular hacking books and is on the required reading list in computer courses at a number of universities. Around February 2003, I was unexpectedly invited to Poland to promote the book. At my first stop in Warsaw, my host offered four security guys in suits with Secret Service-type headsets to handle security. I laughed, thinking it was ridiculous. Surely I didn't need security. They escorted me through the back of the building into a huge shopping mall. The chatter got louder and louder until we walked out into the mall where hundreds of fans were pressed up against a rope. When they saw me, they tried to push forward and the security staff had to hold them back. Thinking they must have mistaken me for some international celebrity, I started looking around for the star myself, but amazingly enough, the crowd really was there for me. My book had become the number one best-selling book in the entire country, even beating out a new book by Pope John Paul II. One local offered an explanation. In ex-communist Poland, if you beat the system, you were considered a hero. After a lifetime of hacking, always working either alone or with one partner, with the main goals of learning more about how computer systems and telecommunication systems worked and being successful at hacking into anything, I was being mobbed like a rock star. It was the last thing I'd ever expected. One of the most personally meaningful memories of this time, however, was when the book tour took me to New York and I finally got to meet the 2,600 supporters who had cheered me through some of my darkest hours via the Free Kevin movement. When I was on my rough ride through the criminal justice system, it meant the world to me that there was an army of people working tirelessly to support me. It gave me more hope and courage than they could ever know. I can never express the true depth of my gratitude to these wonderful people. One of the landmark moments in my life after prison had to be the day when I was finally allowed to use computers again, 8 years after I was first arrested. It was a festive day filled with family and friends from all over the world. A live cable TV show called The Screensavers with Leo Laporte and Patrick Norton asked to televise my first interaction with the internet. On the show with me were Eric Corley, who had headed up the Free Kevin movement and repeatedly proved himself to be my staunchest supporter, and Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, who had become one of my closest friends. They both came on to help me navigate online after so many years away. As a surprise, the Woz presented me with a brand new Apple PowerBook G4 wrapped in paper, covered with a funny cartoon of a guy trying to reach a computer with a stick through the bars of his jail cell. In many ways, getting that laptop from the father of the personal computer was the moment I knew my life was finally starting to turn around. It has now been 11 years since I walked out of prison. I've built a consulting practice that provides a steady flow of business. It has taken me to every part of the United States and every continent except Antarctica. My work today is, to me, nothing short of a miracle. Try to name some illegal activity that, with permission, can be carried out legitimately and benefit everyone. Only one comes to mind. Ethical hacking. I went to prison for my hacking. Now people hire me to do the same things I went to prison for, but in a legal and beneficial way. I would never have expected it, but in the years since my release, I've served as a keynote speaker at countless industry events and corporate meetings, written for the Harvard Business Review, and addressed students and faculty at the Harvard Law School. Whenever some hacker makes the news, I'm asked to comment on Fox, CNN, or other news media. I've appeared on 60 Minutes, Good Morning America, and many, many other programs. I've even been hired by government agencies like the FAA, the Social Security Administration, and, despite my criminal history, an FBI organization, InfraGuard. People often ask if I've completely kicked the hacking habit. Often I still keep hacker's hours, up late, eating breakfast when everyone else has already finished lunch, busy on my computer until 3 or 4 in the morning. And I am hacking again, but in a different way. For Mintnik Security Consulting LLC, I do ethical hacking, using my hacking skills to test companies' security defenses by identifying weaknesses in their physical, technical, and human-based security controls, so they can shore up their defenses before the bad guys exploit them. I do this for companies around the globe, and have been giving some 15 to 20 corporate keynotes a year. My firm also vets security products for companies before new items are released to the market, to see if they live up to the claims being made for them. My company also provides security awareness training, primarily focused on mitigating the threat of social engineering attacks. What I do now fuels the same passion for hacking I felt during all those years of unauthorized access. The difference can be summed up in one word: authorization. I don't need authorization to get in. It's the word that instantly transforms me from the world's most wanted hacker to one of the most wanted security experts in the world. Just like magic. This concludes the reading of Ghost in the Wires, My Adventures as the World's Most Wanted Hacker, by Kevin Mitnick with William L. Simon. Copyright 2011 by Kevin Mitnick. Forward copyright 2011 by Steve Wozniak. This book was read by Ray Porter. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Little Brown and Company and was produced in 2011 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.